A federal labor agency in the U.S. is accusing Elon Musk and his company SpaceX of unlawfully firing employees. The complaint was issued by a regional office of the National Labor Relations Board.
Oh, I see. I guess you better find them unconstitutional then, right?
I don't know why I came here tonight.
Elon?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm too scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest, and China Lake, California. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, so the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to another thrilling edition of The Bradcast, your reliable source for accurate news that actually matters in these outrageously difficult times. That seems a rare thing these days, Desi Doyen.
Well, I guess it depends on where you listen.
I guess it does. Anyway, thank you for joining us today. A quick reminder that voters are heading to the polls on Tuesday in Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Kansas, and Ohio. Those are all for primaries, though there is no Democratic primary for president in Florida because Joe Biden's the only one on the ballot there and under state law in the Sunshine State. If there is only one candidate, the election is effectively canceled. But there are other reasons beyond the presidential contest and its otherwise foregone conclusions to vote in a number of those states. So please remember to do so, because if nothing else, it's also a good chance to make sure you are registered as you think you are, well before November, where we don't need any surprises at this rate, if at all possible. As usual, there's been a whole lot of news since we last spoke to you late last week, but I've got a guest I need to get to momentarily, so pardon me for running through some of these headlines a bit more quickly than I usually like to for now. Over the weekend, media outlets concluded that Russian dictator Vladimir Putin would be reelected for an unprecedented third term. After an election, and I put that word in quotes, in which the Russian strongman ran without any real opposition after all of his legitimate political opponents had been either killed or imprisoned or exiled or otherwise blocked from appearing on the ballot. The former U.S. president and wannabe strongman Donald Trump went on a tear over the weekend during campaign rallies and media appearances, doubling down on his fascistic rhetoric, decrying immigrants with dehumanizing rhetoric, such as describing them as, quote, animals and, quote, not people, and warning that there would be a, quote, bloodbath for the country if he is not elected. Now, seemingly he was referring to the auto industry, though that is certainly disputable given his increasing rhetoric in support of political violence here in the U.S. On Monday, Trump's attorneys informed the New York Court of Appeals that it would be impossible for the supposed billionaire to post a bond for the nearly $500 million that he now owes the state of New York after he, His company and his top executives, including his two eldest sons, were recently found liable for years of bank, tax, and insurance fraud in the state. Also on Monday, it took about 30 years, but Joe Biden's EPA finally joined the rest of the world, or at least 50 other nations or so that did so long ago, in fully banning the use of all types of asbestos, a carcinogenic which has long ago been linked to multiple types of cancer. Also on Monday, the corrupted right-wing U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument in case that, in truth, should never have even made its way all the way up to the high court, focused on the First Amendment and whether the government has the right to notify social media companies about posts that include dangerous information, dangerous lies, such as those about election fraud and false claims about COVID-19 and vaccines, much less the posting of classified material or threats of political violence. And just before airtime today, the U.S. Supreme Court has indefinitely blocked Texas from enforcing, well, a controversial immigration law, as CNN discusses it. But it's a law that would have allowed police to arrest migrants to essentially give the state the right to enforce its own immigration policies over that of the federal government. That law for now is on hold. We'll try to get to some of those stories in a bit, some detail later on today and or as the week unfolds. But given the outrageous nature of so many of the stories that we are forced to cover right now and or inform you about each day. There's a lot of other stuff that falls through the cracks, unfortunately, that might in normal times get a whole hell of a lot more attention, at least from the progressive media. We've spent quite a bit of time over the past few years since Joe Biden took office, and in truth, in the wake of the pandemic, discussing the rise of organized labor in the U.S. in ways that we have not seen, arguably, in about 100 years in this nation, with workers voting to unionize for collective bargaining at fast food outlets like Starbucks and McDonald's. And as you'll recall, a president of the United States, Joe Biden, actually marched with striking workers on the picket line last year for the first time in U.S. history when United Auto Workers struck for long overdue wage increases and improved working conditions at the big three Detroit automakers. It has arguably been a very good few years for organized labor. That's the good news. And that good news continues. But in response to that rise in worker power comes the pushback from the right and from major corporations seeking to tamp down that rise in organized labor. And a number of those corporations are now using their corporate muscle and a lot of corporate resources from record profits to undercut the rise in collective bargaining by workers by going after the constitutionality of the very laws, some of them nearly a century old, the very laws that have afforded the hard-fought rights gained by workers in recent years. As longtime labor reporter Steve Greenhouse reported last week at The Guardian, upset by the surge in union drives, several of the best-known corporations in the U.S. are seeking to cripple the country's top labor watchdog, the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, by having it declared unconstitutional. Some labor experts warn that if those efforts succeed, U.S. labor relations might return to, quote, the law of the jungle. Now, all of this, I should note, while we're otherwise and arguably understandably a bit distracted by a former president and leading contender to be the next one, warning of a bloodbath if he is not elected this year, it's understandable that a lot of this is sort of falling through the cracks, but this is important. As Greenhouse reports, in recent weeks, Elon Musk's SpaceX, as well as Amazon, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's, have all filed legal papers that advance novel arguments aimed at hobbling and perhaps shutting down the NLRB, the federal agency that enforces labor rights and oversees unionization efforts. Those companies are eager to thwart the NLRB after it accused Amazon, Starbucks, and Trader Joe's of breaking the law, in fact, hundreds of times, in their battles against unionization. Roger King, a longtime management side lawyer who is senior labor counsel for the HR Policy Association, said, quote, "It will be a lose-lose if the federal courts overturn the 89-year-old National Labor Relations Act, which has governed labor relations since Franklin Roosevelt was president. Quote, "We will have the law of the jungle, the law of the streets," King said. "It will be who has the most power. It's potential for chaos," he said. And while these efforts have not yet made their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, they are now working their way through the lower courts, which are now stacked with far-right appointees who have allowed much weaker cases to move ahead, including the ridiculous arguments heard at the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday seeking to ban the U.S. government from even communicating with social media outlets in hopes of both informing the public and keeping them safe. So this time, it seems to me, it might be a good idea to keep an eye on what appears to be a concerted and strengthening effort, if I'm understanding Stephen Greenhouse's recent coverage correctly, to undermine nearly 100 years of labor law by gutting what amounts right now to largely the only legal mechanism that union workers and unionizing workers are able to easily turn to: judgments by the National Labor Relations Board and its team of administrative law judges to combat what amounts to flagrant violations of the law by these gigantic companies seeking to prevent workers from unionizing or keep union workers from being afforded the rights that they'd already won from these enormously powerful outfits. Kate Andreas, a Columbia University law professor, said workers would be hurt if the courts issue a sweeping decision that declares both the NLRB and the National Labor Relations Act itself unconstitutional. Without them, she told Greenhouse, workers will be even worse off. It's critical that they continue to exist to protect the basic right to organize and engage in collective bargaining. This, she said, is an assault on rights we have considered fundamental since the New Deal. Joining us now is Stephen Greenhouse, who spent years as a New York Times labor journalist. He continues to do so at outlets like the UK's Guardian, and as an award-winning author of a number of books on labor, including his latest, Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen Greenhouse, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Nice to be here, Brad.
As you noted in your piece at the Guardian last week, the NLRB, as critical as it is to labor law, is already actually incredibly weak in both what it's mandated to do by the law, the National Labor Relations Act, and the fact that it can be and is further hobbled every few years, depending on who's in the White House at any given time. Before we get to the arguments about its constitutionality that is being made by these corporations seeking to undermine labor, what is it that the NLRB actually does which has apparently so irked these corporations during the Biden years?
Good question. So the National Labor Relations Board, which was created in 1935 during the Great Depression, when Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal Congress thought we, the nation, should make it easier for workers to unionize. That will give them greater bargaining power to get higher wages, and that will help lift their families out of poverty and help lift the nation out of the worst depression it had ever seen. So the NLRB functions essentially as a referee, as an umpire, when workers seek to unionize. And it tries to get, you know, workers and unions and companies to follow certain rules that, you know, when workers at a workplace want to unionize, they petition for a union election. And it's illegal, for instance, for companies to fire workers for supporting a union. And all too often companies, and Starbucks is accused of this, companies fire the leaders of unionization efforts to kind of decapitate them, to, you know, kick the bejesus out of the effort, to kill the effort. And the NLRB then comes in as the umpire saying, you know, blows the whistle and says, that's illegal. You shouldn't do that. You can't fire people for supporting a union. So normally there's just, you know, the NLRB says you broke the law, and but it doesn't have the power to fine companies. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the power to fine them one penny for firing, you know, 10 or 20 or 30 Starbucks workers, you know, who supported the union. So many union officials and worker advocates say the NLRB is way too weak. It's pathetic. We need laws to make it stronger. And in many ways, corporations have long gloated, have long smiled at how weak the NLRB is. And like, they'll be slapped on the wrist saying, you naughty boy, you shouldn't fire people illegally. But what's really different now is corporations, instead of just shrugging when they're slapped on the wrist, they're really taking a bazooka and trying to, and going to court to try to have the NLRB declared unconstitutional.
Yep. And that, you know, because I've heard this as well from, you know, from other labor historians and union workers. They told us for years that because the NLRB is so weak, they can make rulings, but they can't really fine. Well, then it pays for these companies to violate the law, you know, to do all they can to prevent unionization. No, there was over 100 findings of violations of law by Starbucks alone over the past year from the NLRB.
So I interviewed John Logan, a professor of labor studies at San Francisco State, mm-hmm. and he says the law is so weak, the penalties are so toothless, that essentially gives a bright green light to companies like Amazon and Starbucks and SpaceX to break the law, to fire workers who support a union, because the companies know that they really can't be punished. And Democrats have tried time after time in recent decades to strengthen the National Labor Relations Act, to create fines, to create real penalties for companies that break the law in fighting unions. Mm-hmm. And five times now, since Lyndon Johnson was president in the 1960s, Republicans have used the filibuster in the Senate to block efforts to strengthen the NLRB and create real penalties so that companies don't continue clobbering workers when they seek to unionize.
And so even with this weak NLRB that has been that way for going on 100 years now, as you suggest, Stephen Greenhouse, these companies are now bringing a bazooka to charge that the NLRB itself is unconstitutional. What? So in simple terms, if possible, on what basis are these companies now making this claim about this 100-year-old institution?
So before I give the specifics, so as many of your listeners know, the Supreme Court and many conservative judges throughout the country have declared war on the so-called administrative state. Mm-hmm. They don't like the federal government being so powerful. So in all sorts of ways, they're trying to knock down the federal, you know, the federal bureaucracy by several notches, weaken it. You know, the Fifth Circuit, Federal Circuit Court in the South, mm-hmm. Has ruled that the Securities and Exchange Commission is unconstitutional in many ways. So some companies, which, you know, see the National Labor Relations Board as a nuisance, said, you know, let's just destroy the whole thing. Let's try to have it declared unconstitutional. It's pesky and pesky. Let's just get rid of it. And the case where this began was the National Labor Relations Board accused SpaceX, mm-hmm. Elon Musk's company, mm-hmm. of illegally firing 8 workers for merely criticizing Emperor Elon because Elon had mocked some women, you know, female workers who accused, you know, some folks at SpaceX of sexual harassment. So Elon, you know, basically said, I don't like the NLRB. Let's try to nuke them. Let's try to have them declared unconstitutional. And then Amazon and Trader Joe's and Starbucks have also filed legal papers seeking to have it declared unconstitutional. And they're basically asserting 3 different reasons for having the NLRB declared unconstitutional. First, they say it violates the 7th Amendment by penalizing companies without a jury trial. You know, the 7th Amendment says thou shalt have a jury trial if you bring a case of common law for more than $20. Mm-hmm. But the NLRB says we don't even bring cases for $20. We can't even fine people. So how can you even declare us unconstitutional?
Right.
A second argument the companies, the corporations are making is that the NLRB's judges, so-called administrative law judges, exercise executive power And if they are exercising executive power, then the president should be totally free to remove them.
Mm-hmm.
But the labor board says, "What do you mean our judges exercise executive powers? They exercise judicial power like any judges. How can you say they exercise executive power?" And they say these corporations are really reaching, you know, very far, overreaching to try to have the board declared unconstitutional. And thirdly, mm-hmm. the companies say that the National Labor Relations Board violates the separation of powers by exercising executive, legislative, and judicial functions. And they say that just has to be unconstitutional because the agencies are doing all these things. And the labor board responds first that we don't really exercise executive power. Yes, we exercise judicial power by deciding whether companies broke the law, unions broke the law. We exercise legislative power functions by recommending some rules.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, stepping back, you know, the NLRB, many federal officials, the dean of UC Berkeley Law School just wrote an excellent piece saying, you know, these federal agencies have been found constitutional time and again since the New Deal for the past 90, 95 years. They've been declared, you know, mm-hmm. constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And they fear that the Supreme Court and many judges have moved so far to the right
yep.
that they're really ready to blow up the system of federal agencies that generally has worked very well over the past 90 years, protecting workers, protecting consumers, protecting investors. And, you know, the legal experts I interviewed, including some, you know, very well-known corporate lawyers, said, you know, that SpaceX and Starbucks and Amazon and Trader Joe's should be careful what they wish for.
Yeah.
Because if you blow up the NLRB, if you blow up the Securities and Exchange Commission, if you blow up the EPA, if you blow up, you know, OSHA, you know, which oversees safety and health,
right,
it's going to be a disaster for Americans. And people, you know, and they haven't thought through what this will mean. And some people say, well, Congress will just fix it once the Supreme Court overturns it. But as,
yeah.
as, you know, as all of you know, Congress is so dysfunctional. You know, I think my 5-year-old grandson can get far more done than Congress nowadays.
Yeah. Ask the people who are being prevented from voting how Congress did when it came to correcting the Voting Rights Act after this corrupted Supreme Court gutted the major section of
that law. Section 5 of the Voting
yeah.
Rights Act, yeah, which was unanimously passed by the Senate. And we have a Chief
yep.
Justice who said, you know, once you confirm me for the Supreme Court, all I'm going to do is call balls and strikes. And
yep.
be a very modest, humble justice.
Mm-hmm.
Blows up this very important Voting Rights Act that was passed unanimously by the Senate.
And they That's have done this
calling balls and strikes. Yeah.
They have done this in case after case after case. They are not calling balls and strikes. And now that, you know, now that we've got a 6-3 court, it seems like all bets are off. They're, you know, undermining the EPA, the so-called administrative state, as you describe it. This is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this right now, you know, before it makes its way up to the Supreme Court, because sure enough, that is where this seems to be headed. Stephen Greenhouse, you mentioned the these administrative judges that, if it's an executive branch agency, then the president ought to be able to fire them. How are those administrative judges, how are those folks appointed in the first place? And is the complaint here that, Donald Trump didn't get to come in and clean the slate and appoint whoever he wants as administrative judges on the NLRB?
You know, the president appoints the administrative law judges and they're there, you know, for good behavior. You know, they mm-hmm. can only be kicked off for good behavior, for bad behavior, for, mm-hmm. You know, for breaking the law. I mean, we wouldn't want, you know, I imagine, you know, these corporations that want the NLRB declared unconstitutional, they would not want a Joe Biden to fire some administrative law judges because those judges ruled in favor of Elon Musk or in favor of Starbucks instead of in favor of unions or workers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the purpose is to insulate, you know, these judges so they can act with some independence and really try to achieve justice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, basically the corporations say, you know, screw that, you know, we're worried these judges and this whole labor board apparatus, you know, is making our lives difficult, even though it can't fine us. And let's just get rid of the whole thing.
And, you know, you cite in your article at The Guardian, Harvard Law Professor Benjamin Sachs, who observes that it's troubling to see companies like Trader Joe's and Starbucks, which hold themselves out as progressive, quote, willing to sign on to legal theories that should threaten not only our labor rights, but our ability to have clean air, regulate food safety, and assure safe and healthy workplaces. But really, should we be surprised, Stephen? You know, we've been watching with some pretty brutal strong-arm tactics from Starbucks, from their corporate attorneys against store employees attempting to unionize in recent years. What should we take from the fact that even the most seemingly progressive corporations, Trader Joe's, Starbucks, they ultimately end up on the same legal side as, you know, corporations like Elon Musk's SpaceX, which, as you note, is sort of leading the way in challenging the NLRB's existence, you know, charging that it is an unconstitutionally structured agency. I mean, if the most theoretically progressive corporations in the world are still willing to go along with the hardest right-wing Elon Musk, what should that tell us about not only those corporations, but about the necessity of the NLR, the National Labor Relations Board?
So, Brad, in my book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, I write that, you know, the United States corporate sector is more anti-union than the corporate sector in any other wealthy industrial nation, whether mm-hmm. Britain, France, Germany, Japan, Italy, mm-hmm. Australia, you name it. And I used to be the New York Times economics correspondent mm-hmm. in Europe, and I interviewed a lot of, you know, big corporate officials in Europe. And, you know, they don't hate unions the way American executives do. They realize mm-hmm. that unions are legitimate institutions. They call them social partners, mm-hmm. and they realize they have to work with unions to make the company more productive and profitable and to make the economy more prosperous for everyone. In the United States, there seems to be this, you know, consensus, this almost unanimous feeling among American corporations that unions are bad, they're a nuisance. And then there are many companies like Amazon, Starbucks, which, you know, treat unions like cockroaches. You try to stamp out, you try to crush. Mm-hmm. And so we have this weird situation where these supposedly progressive companies like REI and Trader Joe's and Starbucks, you know, they're kind of infected by the mentality of corporate America. Maybe their executives went to, you know, Harvard Business School or whatever business school and learned that, you know, you shouldn't tolerate companies you shouldn't tolerate unions because they might get in the way of your managerial brilliance. They might reduce your autonomy. Oops, they might even reduce profits a little. And so, you know, it's weird that these, you know, progressive companies are fighting tooth and nail against unions. And I think, you know, American executives have this mentality that it's so important to have maximal flexibility. It's so important to have maximal autonomy. And while in other countries, leading executives accept unions, they work with union leaders, they try mm-hmm. to figure out how to work together to make workers richer and company profits higher. Here, there's often an allergy, you know, a total antagonism yeah. towards unions, and that let's just keep them out because we don't care that the laws say that workers should have the right to unionize, to bargain collectively, to improve their wages, to improve their conditions, to help create a more prosperous country for everyone. They just want to maximize their flexibility and maximize their company's profits. And if it means breaking the law and fighting unions, and all these companies, Amazon, Trader Joe's, REI,
yep.
Starbucks have been accused by the NLRB of breaking the law and fighting the union, then they say, so be it.
Yep.
They're really eager to keep unions out.
They really see them as an enemy. I mean, and if you're talking about, you know, Donald Trump and his phrase enemy of the people, I mean, these people really are enemies of the workers, enemy of the laborers who have brought these companies record profits in recent years. And yet there are still, even the most so-called progressive of them, Trader Joe's, Starbucks, are still trying to undermine the ability for these. If they get rid of these administrative judges, if they find the NLRB itself to be unconstitutional, Your story reports that it will be the Wild West out there. Where will they go? Where, you know, I guess they can still file suit, but you have to go to an Article II court, pay a lot of money, take a whole lot of time to bring what will amount to thousands and thousands of cases to courts that are already overburdened and don't have enough time to handle all the cases they're already dealing with?
So, Brad, that's a great question. And I think there are two answers. So in the 1930s, there used to be this phrase, industrial self-help, meaning you want higher wages. You know, the boss has some thugs who want to beat the crap out of you. So like you go on strike, you sit in, you close the place down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was maybe not the wild, wasn't the Wild West, but we had sit down strikes. Mm-hmm. Literally violence between, company thugs and,
right,
and union folks.
Mm-hmm.
And it got very, very ugly. And one of the reasons Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act to give a federal backing for labor unions was to stop all this very ugly stuff that was going on in the streets. And some people fear that if the courts overturn the National Labor Relations Board and the National Labor Relations Act, there might be somewhat of return to this, ugly, violent strikes, violent efforts to suppress workers, and it might just become very, very messy.
Mm.
That's one thing that might happen. And second, if workers who are fired for supporting a union can no longer go to the National Labor Relations Board, they'll try to bring lawsuits in Article III courts, and they might really flood the courts, and the judges. The conservative judges who might move to overturn the NLRB will say, holy crap, now we're being inundated with all these lawsuits that we don't want to handle. So that's why even some corporate lawyers warn SpaceX and Starbucks and Amazon, be careful what you're asking for, because it might make things difficult for you.
Yep.
Another thing that might happen is if the federal courts overturn the National Labor Relations Board, then states would no longer be preempted by federal law, a liberal state like California or Oregon or Washington state or New York state or Massachusetts or Connecticut or New Jersey, they might pass their own laws that make it far easier for workers to unionize than the current federal law does. And again, people tell the corporations who are trying to overturn the NLRB, be careful what you're trying to do here. Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, because they may bring some labor laws. California could bring some labor laws with some real teeth that right now the neutered since its inception NLRB has not been able to bring against these companies. Stephen, I've got
and
just...
Gavin Newsom might really want to do that as part of his efforts to win the Democratic nomination 2028 to show how pro-union he is.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got just a minute or two here. Two quick points I want to try to hit. Some of these companies, according to your reporting at The Guardian, have argued that the NLRB has taken a radical leftward shift in recent years. A, is that true? And B, if so, isn't it about damn time after they've been, held to account for so many years of doing the bidding for management rather than labor under, various Republican and Democratic presidents alike?
So two responses. One, Ronald Reagan or George Bush are in office, and Republicans are president, it swings to the right. It becomes more pro-business. When Democrats win, it swings more to the left, becomes more pro-union. And Republicans will automatically say it's gone radical left.
Right.
There is somewhat of a difference now because the current general counsel, the chief lawyer for the NLRB, is very aggressive, is pushing some innovative legal theories, that were in, well, they actually, they were enforced in the 1930s and 40s. And she says the law has been greatly misinterpreted by the conservative courts, and they're just trying to restore things the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
And unions say, go Jennifer Abruzzo, go General Counsel Abruzzo.
Mm-hmm.
And companies which were so accustomed to the NLRB kind of being a lapdog,
yep,
are really apoplectic that she's trying to enforce the law so aggressively.
Poor them. Stephen, before I let you go, in recent years, there have been a number of cases whether it's on Obamacare, on the use of the safe and long-approved drug mifepristone for abortion, the case on Monday heard by the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the government and social media outlets, cases that seemed absurd on their face at the lower courts that kind of made me, you know, not even want to bother covering them. They seemed so ridiculous, but they ended up making their way on up to the Supreme Court, incredibly, anyway. So, you know, I greatly appreciate you're sort of raising the alarm right now about this, the seemingly concerted effort by some of the nation's largest companies. Where does this matter stand right now in the courts, and how quickly might it move its way all the way up to SCOTUS on its current trajectory?
Good question. So one crazy issue. So it's SpaceX that brought the first lawsuit to try to have the NLRB declared unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And SpaceX is based in California. But California has liberal judges. So SpaceX brought the lawsuit in Texas, mm-hmm. which has the nation's most conservative federal judges.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Labor Relations Board and the federal government are saying, no, this lawsuit should be heard in California, where the federal judges are more liberal and much more likely to uphold the NLRB. And SpaceX is saying, no, this should be heard in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a good chance this can be heard in Texas, which really, and it has, they're extremely pro-business, anti-union judges in Texas. And I think if the case moves forward in Texas, there's a good chance some lowly district court judge is going to rule the NLRB unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, I think it might move pretty quickly to the Supreme Court. Quickly means in a year or two, not in 3 months or 6 months.
Right. Well,
but if the district court rules the NLRB unconstitutional nationwide, we are in, you know, we are through the looking glass. We are in Never Never Land. It's very unclear what that all means. It will get very messy, is all I can say.
We are, I'm afraid, already far through that looking glass at this point, Stephen Greenhouse. So thank you for sounding the alarm. Really appreciate it. I will, of course, link to your article over at The Guardian. Major U.S. corporations threaten to return labor to, quote, law of the jungle. Stephen Greenhouse is a journalist and author focusing on labor for years. He used to be with The New York Times, now writing over at The Guardian. And his newest book is Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. You can get more information on that at stephengreenhouse.com. And you can and should follow him on, yes, Elon Musk's site, still known as Twitter, at Greenhouse NYT. Stephen, great speaking with you. I hope thank you for your critical coverage. I hope you don't mind if we stay in touch with you as this issue and related labor issues move forward in the months ahead.
That's fine, Brad. Happy to talk. Happy to be here. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir. Greatly appreciate it. All right, we got to get to a quick break here, running a little bit late. We will come back with a couple of those stories, at least, that I mentioned at the top of the hour that are coming in over the weekend. Lots to get to today. Straight ahead on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, it's Brad. Well, we are here in another critical presidential election year. We cover elections like no other outlet in the nation. This election year will be a big one like none other. It could even be the last one, depending on how it goes. Seriously. Please help the broadcast continue in this critical election year. Support our work right now with a generous donation via bradblog.com/donate. Help keep the broadcast and bradblog.com free for all. We couldn't do any of this without you. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate right now. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. Yeah, kinda. Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from Bradblog.com. One of Donald Trump's favorite strongmen, that would be President Vladimir Putin, is set to tighten his grip on Russia, the country that he has ruled since the turn of the century, with partial results in over the weekend from Russia's carefully stage-managed election indicating, you will be shocked, a huge victory for the Kremlin leader in a result that was a foregone conclusion. Putin appears to be garnering about 88% of the vote, if you can imagine that, according to preliminary results reported on Sunday by Russia's Central Election Commission. That means that presumably, if he remains alive and is not taken into custody by any of the more than 100 nations who are legally obligated to arrest him if he steps foot on their soil, Vladimir Putin will rule until at least 2030, when he'll be 77 years old. He would be Russia's longest serving leader since Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin, and he would be securing a third full decade of rule, with most opposition candidates either dead or jailed, exiled or barred from running, with dissent effectively outlawed at this point in Russia ever since it launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 22. Putin faced no credible challenge to his rule. Constitutional changes since 2008 in Russia actually removed presidential term limits that would allow Putin to stay in power, if he wants, until 2036. In a victory lap at his election headquarters late Sunday, Putin said the election had, quote, consolidated national unity, and that there were many tasks ahead for Russia as it continues its course of confrontation with the West. Now, by way of quick reminder, at least two of Putin's fiercest opponents have died in just recent months after leading a failed uprising in June last year. Wagner mercenary chief Yevgeny Prigozhin was killed 2 months later after his plane crashed while traveling from Moscow to St. Petersburg. The Kremlin, of course, denied any involvement in that death. And this weekend's elections were held just about a month after Alexei Navalny, Putin's most formidable opponent, died in an Arctic penal colony. Navalny's family and supporters have accused Putin of being responsible for his death, though the Kremlin rejects those claims as well, of course. Navalny's widow had urged Russians to turn out collectively, and they've got to be very careful about how they protest at all. You can't even walk out into Red Square in Moscow and hold up a piece of paper that is blank in objection of their horrific assault invasion of Ukraine. You can't even walk out with a blank piece of paper and hold it up without being hauled away at this point. But his widow, Yulia Navalnaya, had urged Russians to turn out collectively at noon in each time zone at the polls as a show of opposition. On Sunday, the final day of voting, just show up. If everyone shows up at noon at the same time, we will be sending a message. And, well, they did send that message. A CNN team in Moscow report they saw the line outside of a polling station there grow rapidly at midday as part of that so-called noon against Putin demonstration that was inspired by Navalny. A woman waiting in line told CNN, "This is the first time in my life I have ever seen a queue for elections in Russia." Asked why she had come at that hour, she replied simply, "You know why. I think everybody in this queue knows why." Similar protests were staged at Russian embassies across Europe with large crowds gathering at noon in London and Paris and Berlin and elsewhere. Navalny's widow attended a demonstration in Berlin at noon, waiting in line with other voters in a display of opposition. More than 60 Russians were detained across at least 16 cities on the final day of voting, according to independent human rights groups. Russia also held the presidential election in four Ukrainian regions that it annexed unlawfully during its full-scale invasion. Ukraine said the elections violated international law, would be designated, quote, null and void. Russia installed authorities in occupied Ukraine reported high turnout of more than 80% in those territories, but evidence has emerged of voter coercion. The Russian Telegram channels show Russian soldiers accompanying election officials as they go house to house to collect votes in those areas. One video, for example, from Luhansk showed an elderly woman inside her apartment filling out an election paper and putting it in the ballot box while a man in army fatigue stands over her with a rifle slung across his chest. After the release of preliminary results on Sunday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called Putin a, quote, dictator and Russia's election a sham. He said it's clear to everyone in the world that this individual, as has happened so often in history, is simply sick with power and is doing everything he can to rule for life. There is no evil he will not commit to prolong his personal power, Zelensky said, and there is no one in the world who is immune to this. In not unrelated news today, Donald Trump, who reveres Putin's power over his people and his ability to use thuggery to remain in power, to remain president for life, Donald Trump continues to fight for his own political life. In New York, at least, that effort is not going well today. Donald Trump's lawyers told a New York appellate court on Monday that it's impossible for him to post a bond covering the full amount of a $454 million civil fraud judgment while he appeals it. The former president's lawyers wrote in a court filing that, quote, obtaining an appeal bond in the full amount of the judgment is not possible under the circumstances presented. Okay, cool. Then just forget the bond. Just give them the, quote, more than $400 million in cash that you claimed you had on hand when you testified about it just last year, Donald. Wait, what? You were lying about that too? Trump's lawyers asked the state's appeals court to overturn a previous ruling requiring that he post a bond covering the full amount in order to halt enforcement while he appeals the judgment in New York Attorney General Letitia James's lawsuit.
In other words, he wants special treatment.
Of course he does.
Like.
Of course. He deserves it, he thinks. In all, Trump and co-defendants, including his company, his sons Eric and Don Jr., and other executives owe some $467.3 million to obtain a bond. They would be required to post collateral worth about $557 million, according to Trump's lawyers. Well, no problem. Trump told us over and over again that he is a multi-billionaire, that he is so rich. So what's the holdup, Don? Pay him the money. You're so rich. He's appealing Judge Arthur Engron's ruling in February that he and his company and top executives, including his son, schemed for years to deceive banks and insurers by inflating his wealth on financial statements used to secure loans and make deals. Oh, I get it. That fraud that you just got busted for is the same fraud that you're running into now, isn't it? But wait, he told us, by the way, that his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, it's not worth the $18 million that the Palm Beach County assessor said that it was worth. It was outrageous that he would say such a thing, that in fact, it's worth more than $2.5 billion. Not $18 million, $2.5 billion, according to Trump. So if that's true, why not just put that up for collateral, right? Well, apparently the bond companies ain't buying Trump's fraud on that either anymore at this point. Trump has until March 25 to pay the judgment or obtain a stay in court, which would prevent enforcement while he's appealing that ruling. Now, there was some misreporting when the verdict came on this originally, when it was originally issued. It was claimed that by a number of media outlets that Trump had to either pay up in full or put up a bond for the full amount within 30 days of the judgment in order to be able to appeal it to a higher court at all. That's not actually accurate. Trump can appeal whether he puts up the money or a bond or not. But if he doesn't put up the money or a bond within 30 days, the state may then begin to execute that judgment to obtain that money from Trump in a number of ways as the state sees fit. The Attorney General Tish James has said she will seek to seize some of Trump's assets if he is unable to pay. And that's what would begin within 30 days of the issuance of the original ruling. So he can go ahead and appeal even without putting up the money, but nothing is going to stop Tish James from trying to get that money from him if he hasn't guaranteed it with a bond or put up the cash in full. In a court filing last week, the state argued that a full bond was necessary, in part because Trump's lawyers, quote, have never demonstrated that Trump's liquid assets will be enough to satisfy the full amount of this judgment following appeal. Trump's lawyers previously proposed posting a $100 million bond instead. But an appellate division judge rejected that after an emergency hearing. But Trump maintains that he's worth several billion dollars. He testified that he had more than $400 million in cash just sitting around in his bank, in addition to properties and other investments. So cool. Put it up for your bond if you got it, buddy. Unless, of course, you were lying about that too, which I'm sure, since it was official testimony under oath in a legal case, he would have never been lying about that, right? So instead of a bond for $100 million in cash, why not offer one? Maybe they'll take it for about $400 million that you claim you have on hand. Or maybe $300 million if $100 million of it is already spoken for. In January, a jury also ordered Trump to pay $83.3 million to writer E. Jean Carroll for defaming her after she accused him of sexually assaulting her back in the 90s. That, in addition to the $5 million that a jury awarded Carroll in a related trial confirming the sexual assault last year, Trump has put more than $5.5 million in an escrow account while he appeals that decision. So that's about $100 million tied up. He said he had $4 million. So go ahead, offer $300 million. You've got $300 million. Go ahead and offer it, Donnie. Why not? What's the holdup? Oh, you were lying. And I'm trying to behave under FCC radio in what I have to say about all of that today, Desi Doyen.
Yes, and I totally understand that that feeling about having to come up against FCC constraints.
Yes,
but
yes.
I think perhaps, you know, another option, Trump could just ask his son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
He did get $2 billion from the Saudi Arabia
right
after leaving office when he left the White House. So maybe he's got some spare
change. He confront him the dough.
Maybe. After maybe
all,
he's good for it.
He not only did he get him $2 billion from Saudi Arabia, he pardoned his dad. Sounds like Jared owes him. Come on, help your father-in-law, dude. I didn't give out the phone number, but it looks like folks know it. Larry from San Pedro is giving us a call on a related matter. Hey, Larry, welcome to the broadcast, sir. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Brad.
Hi, Larry.
There is a 30-day delay.
Mm-hmm.
In the Stormy Daniels trial.
Yep.
So instead of March 25th, we're now looking at April 25th.
Mm-hmm.
But say a few words, if you would, Brad, about what the penalties will be in that case if we get them convicted. And I am chomping at the bit for this criminal trial to start. I'll take my answer off of you.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Well, in fact, the penalties, as I understand it, there's 34 felony counts that he is facing. As I recall, it's something like 5 years max, if I remember, 5 or 7 years that he could face for each of those 34 different felony charges. I can't do math while I'm on air, but it's a whole lot of years in prison that he could be looking at. Of course, that's if he's held to the max on all the accounts, if he's held found guilty of them. But yeah, that's a very serious case. And I know a lot of people have been sort of downplaying it. Oh, it's only hush money to a porn star while his wife was nursing his youngest son in order to help him cheat to win the 2016 election, because he cannot win elections apparently by just, you know, being the most popular and having the best ideas. He's got to cheat. So that's what he did in 2016. And now, to some extent, perhaps, maybe, we will see in an additional 30 days if he is held to account for that finally. By the way, that 30-day extension is due in no small part to the way Donald Trump gamed the system, and I expect that will also come out in court, and we'll find out that it was, in fact, Donald Trump who pretended he didn't care about this information, and then suddenly last week he said, hey, there's tens of thousands of documents that suddenly I'd like to see. Well, that's going to come out in court under Judge Juan Marchand in a hearing on March 25, the date that this trial was set previously to begin. And he may not get that full 30-day delay, depending on how the judge sees it and if he decides that Trump is merely doing this in order to delay this case. Juan Marchand is not a pushover. Juan Marchand is not Aileen Cannon down in Florida.
And it does seem like this might be the only criminal trial that might actually have a chance of going to trial before the election.
Going to trial and being completed before the election. It's very possible.
We'll see. I mean, there will be lots and lots of, I'm sure, in-trial delays and motions and stuff.
Because that's what he does. That's his only way out of this mess. He has done it. These cases are pretty much airtight if you bother to look at the evidence. And I know the MAGA folks that follow him do not bother to look at the evidence, do not bother to read the indictments. But some of us do. And these are damn good cases. Pretty airtight. So I would be shocked, frankly, if he survives any of them if they get to an actual trial. All right, we have got to get out. The fun will continue on tomorrow's broadcast. Until then, my thanks again to our guest today, Stephen Greenhouse. You can find him again on the Twitters at GreenhouseNYT or StephenGreenhouse.com. Buy his new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up. You can also drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. My thanks as well today, of course, to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our board operator, Wendell Handy, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, you just want to hear it again, share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you may do so for free anytime at bradblog.com. All right, we will see you there and all of the above until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day workers at Wagner Electric in St. Louis ended their 12-day walkout in exchange for promised negotiations regarding union recognition, higher wages, and fewer work hours. Wagner held defense contracts to provide detonators and firing pins for munitions. With the U.S. entrance into World War I, the orders increased, as did the labor shortage. In this instance, more women entered the workforce. Wagner was no exception. During this period, nearly a quarter of the St. Louis factory workers were female. Yet, the unionized industries made no attempt to organize them. Amid a strike that rocked the city, about 1,000 men and women struck at Wagner on March 6th. They demanded the reinstatement of co-workers who had been fired for attending a machinist union meeting. A week later, close to 2,700 workers were on strike. The male workers at Wagner made less than half of their counterparts in the unionized industries, while their women co-workers made half of that. Workers contended that Wagner violated federal contracts by refusing to honor the 8-hour workday and equal pay for equal work. Historian Rosemary Furrer notes the ordnance department reached a tentative deal to get workers back to the job and then spiked negotiations by smearing strikers as unpatriotic. the company refused to address long-standing grievances. According to Catherine Corbett, Wagner Electric also required workers to sign loyalty pledges to the company. Over half of the workforce would walk out the following month with the support of Mother Jones. Workers appealed to a more sympathetic War Labor Board, but found they could not get the agreements they demanded until the years of industrial organizing of the 1930s. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Hi, everybody. Juliana Forlano here from the Juliana Forlano Show on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Do you like to know what's going on in the world but don't like walking away from your news show feeling all depressed or jacked up? Do you like political humor? Then check out our show, the Juliana Forlano Show, Saturday at 11 a.m., Sunday at 9 p.m. on the Progressive Voices Network, or find us at julianaforlano.com.